Morning of today's daf and Shavuos is Lamed. We start today the fourth parak of Masechta, and today we're going to be covering the topic of Shavuos Eidus, or we should say better. I'm starting the topic of Shavuos Eidus in this fourth parak of the Masechta, so we are introducing ourselves to a new type of Shua, one which will be liable for a carbon if a person makes such a Shua b'shogeg. And as we'll learn over the course of this morning, even if it's done b'mezin, one of those rare opportunities, and I say rare, I don't think there's another case. I think it's totally exceptional in which a person is going to bring a carbon for a blatant violation of the Torah. Okay, so just by word of introduction, in this Masechta so far, we've covered more than half the Masechta. So we've covered for the first two parakim Tumas Beis Hamikdash, Tumas Beis Hamikdash, Tumas Karbanos, and that, as the Gemara pointed out at the very beginning of the Masechta, so it only comes here in this Masechta. It doesn't really belong here. It's an inyan in Tumas Tahara. It's an inyan in Kedushas Beis Hamikdash. It's in Yanei Kachim. It's like 0 for 3. It doesn't really belong here, but it is placed over here in the beginning of this Masechta because it has to do with the carbon olah v'yared. It's a time where a person has to bring a specific type of carbon chatos, carbon olah v'yared. And if a person is metame the Beis Hamikdash, or if he eats karbanos while in the state of tuma, and he has a halama, so the first two parakim cover that topic. Then, after that, the third parak, which we just concluded, is Shavuos Bitui. A person makes a shvua laharo leitiv, either to do something or to not do something, or to have done something or not done something, two for the future, two for the past, and he does so b'shogeg, he does so in a state of shogeg, so he's going to be chayv a carbon olah v'yared as well. So for that, now we dedicate the third parak of Masechta Shavuos. And now in this fourth parak, so we're going to be talking about Shavuos Eidus. Shavuos Eidus is a parak dedicated to the topic of a person who has testimony, but refuses to give the testimony that he has. And more to the point, he swears he doesn't know anything. The pasuk says, "V'hu aid," that the person is a witness, right? "V'hu yadav v'lo ora'ah," he saw, he knew, and he refuses to give his testimony. So repression, huh? Repression, just one second, I'll get to that. So repression, if a person represses the testimony that he has, suppresses the testimony that he has, and simply does not give it. So under those circumstances, that too is a scenario in which he has to bring a carbon olah v'yared. So first of all, a couple of things, just general points, before we start with the Mishnah and the Gemara, and that is that it's a mitzvah to testify, right? It's an uncomfortable mitzvah, meaning we know, generally speaking, derecha derechi noam, the words of the Torah are pleasant, and the paths of the Torah are pleasant, and it's generally speaking, the Torah never puts us in uncomfortable positions. But if you have information and about an individual and you have to go to court to testify, so it's an uncomfortable mitzvah. And there's a recognition on the part of the Torah that it's an uncomfortable mitzvah. I'll explain that better in just a second. But nevertheless, it's a mitzvah to testify, even though it means that somebody's going to be losing out on money because of your testimony. Or even worse, someone is subject to corporal punishment based on your testimony. Could be even worse. Someone's subject to capital punishment based on your testimony. And just to also highlight how uncomfortable it may be, so now you make yourself susceptible to Eidim Zomimin, meaning that whatever is now going to happen to the defendant may in fact turn around and happen to you. And so really the truth of the matter is that testifying under certain circumstances can be life-threatening. And nevertheless, with all that stated, it's a mitzvah to testify. A person has testimony and refuses to give it, so he's violating an issur in the Torah. So fine. So it's a mitzvah to say, it's a positive mitzvah to testify. And on top of that, suppression of testimony is a lav, it's a lo sase in the Torah. And if a person denies having known something, under certain circumstances, he's going to have to bring a carbon olah v'yared. Now this Shavuos Eidus is going to be different than the previous parak that we had regarding Shavuos Bitui. Shavuos Bitui, a person is going to be chayv a carbon under almost all circumstances. In fact, the last mission we learned together in yesterday's daf, it applies to men and women, krovim, rechokim, ksherim, psulim, etc., etc., etc. So in other words, it really is an all-encompassing issur and applies to everybody under most circumstances. However, when it comes to Shavuos Eidus, because this is all about testimony, so therefore it's extraordinarily limited. It only applies to people who could testify and under the circumstances in which the testimony would be valid testimony. Furthermore, as we're going to be learning, we'll touch on it in today's daf, but we're going to be learning it in more detail as we get through the perek, it only applies to Eidus Mamon. It only applies to testimony regarding a monetary case. Meaning that on corporal cases, on corporal punishment, so the Shavuos Eidus will not apply. I should say better, the carbon shuas edus will not apply. It only applies to edus regarding mamun. That would be the only scenario in which if a person suppresses his testimony and does not come forward with that which he knows, so then he's going to be chayv a carbon ole v'yored. Under other circumstances of edus, he's still violating a law, but it's not eligible for a carbon ole v'yored. So this shvuos ha'edus is going to be extraordinarily more limited, much more limited than the previous shvuos ha'bitui. Okay, with all that stated, just by way of just a short introduction, let's begin the Mishnah. Shvuos ha'edus, no'agis ba'anashim v'lo b'anashim. Contrasting that to the previous Mishnah we did at the end of yesterday's daf, this shvuos ha'edus only applies to men, not to women. Berachokim v'lo b'krovim, to non-relatives, not to relatives. B'kshirim v'lo b'psulim. People are kosher, not people are apostle. Meaning that we know that certain people are not eligible to testify. Women don't testify. Psulim don't testify. The third parak of Sanhedrin goes through the whole list of people who are apostle ages who can't testify. So if you meet that criteria of somebody who can't testify, even if, we'll say a chiddush, even if, let's say, a psul is only psul derabanan, which the Mishnah over there in Sanhedrin lists all the psul derabanan, Sachi, Pekubia, Malvab, Ribis, etc., etc. Those are psuli derabbanan, and they're not psuli deraisa. Still, even though you're puzzled on the derabbanan level, you're no longer eligible to testify, and therefore you're not going to be subject to the carbon ol of yorei. The eino nohagas ala bruin lahayi bifnei beisim v'shlo bifnei beisim epiatzmo. So, and it applies to anyone who is fit to testify, and that would be either in Basin or outside of Basin. Now, if you are adjured by others, other people now put you under oath. So under those circumstances, you're only going to be chayav a carbon shvua if you lie in court when adjured by others. This is the opinion of Rameir. And according to the Chachamim, whether or not you make the shvua on your own or you're placed under oath by others, you're not going to be chayav a carbon ol v'yared until you do so in a court. The Machlokshim, Rameir, and the Chachamim will be explained much better when we get to the Gemara. V'chayav mazdon ha-shvua v'al shigagasa im zdon ha-edus. When are you chayav the carbon ol of the yorin? When you are zadon ha-shvua, even when you know you're swearing, and you're swearing falsely, meaning so you now deny that you have testimony, and you even swear to the fact that you don't have testimony, and you know full well you have testimony. You're still going to be chayav a carbon ol of a yared. As I pointed out in the intro, this is unusual. This is a rarity in halacha where you're going to be bringing a carbon on a deliberate violation of the Torah. Perhaps one could say that the reason why the Torah allows for a carbon under such circumstances is because this is an acknowledgement on the part of the Torah that it's really uncomfortable to testify. It's almost as if the Torah is saying, look, I understand. It's not right. Of course it's not right, but I get it. You don't want to come to court. You don't want to testify. You're really putting yourself out there. It's really uncomfortable. And more than that, you're causing a monetary loss to somebody. I get it. So obviously it's not right, and you'll have to bring a carbon, but there's still going to be a chance for a carbon, even for a deliberate violation. Chayav nazdon ha-shvua ve'al shigagasa im zdon ha-edus. And also a case of shogeg with zdon ha-edus. What does that mean? Look at Rashi. I'm going to read the Rashi inside. Ashigasim zdon ha'edus shemizidim heim v'yodim lo edus. In other words, on one hand, they know they have the testimony, and lying that they don't have the testimony on that, they're a zadon. Avashogim heim ala karban kishar shigas bitui l'shavado kimne ba'omi yodei ani shishvuzu asura aval eni yodei shechayim ala karban. What didn't they know about? They didn't know about the karban. Meaning, as we discussed, when trying to give a scenario for Shavuos Bitui Sha'avar, remember the Gemara we did just a couple of days ago. Gemara really struggled to come up with a scenario in which, what's the case of Shogeg L'Sha'avar? L'asid, it's very simple. I made a Shavuah, I won't eat the loaf of bread, and I forgot about my Shavuah. That's the case of Shogeg. What's the Shogeg on L'Sha'avar? Meaning, what did I forget about when I said I didn't eat the loaf of bread? If I totally forgot that I ate the loaf of bread, that's not Shogeg, that's Anus. In other words, I think I'm telling the truth. So the case of Shogeg, as we described back there, was where I knew I ate the loaf of bread. I swear I didn't eat the loaf of bread, but I didn't know that there was a carbon ramification. Okay, I forgot about that. Right, I was unaware of that. That's considered Shogeg Lagabe Shvuos Bitul L'Sha'avar. So Rashi over here is explaining our Mishnah, saying that when it comes to the case of Shogeg regarding Shvuos Ha'edus, so the aide knows that he's lying. He knows that he has information, and when he swears, he knows. When he swears he doesn't have information, he knows it's a lie, but what he's a shogeg on is he didn't know the ramifications. He didn't know that there would be a carbon ramification under these circumstances. That would be the shogeg scenario of Shavuos Eidos. Contrast that to the next case of the Mishnah. The in chayav mashig gasa. If, however, you're a total shogeg, what does that mean, total shogeg? Rashi. Im shogeg him legamre. Kisvum shein yodim lo eidos v'acha kach nistru sharei anusim hein lo karina behen nishmin l'shaker. If, let's say, the person at the time when he swears really has no recollection of the events that that occurred, meaning he had a fault of memory, and now when he's swearing, he really believes he doesn't know. This is not a case where you're going to be eligible to bring a carbon. This is a case where you really thought you were telling the truth. Under these circumstances, you're not going to bring a carbon olav yored. Umahin chayavna azdona shvua carbon olav yored. So, and what does a person bring under these circumstances when he's eligible to bring a carbon? So the Mishnah tells us what we already know, is that he's chayav to bring a carbon olav yored. Okay. Adkan divrei HaMishnah, a number of things in the Mishnah need to be ironed out, which we're going to get to in the Gemara, but for the most part, our Gemara is going to have a general discussion regarding Eidos, meaning, as we pointed out in the introduction, in other words, for a person to be chayav a carbon olav yored, he has to swear that he doesn't have information, but it has to be information that could be provided as an aid. And so with that in mind, so basically what we're going to be discussing today, some of the more basic parameters of what qualifies as an aid. So the first thing, which we already learned in the Mishnah, is that it's men and not women. Right? Men testify, women don't testify. Women do not have the ability to testify in court. There are extenuating circumstances. The Gemara in the end of the Yevamos, the last couple of Parakim in Yevamos. There are circumstances in which women can provide testimony. Right? Edus Aisha, man's husband went away, didn't come back. We don't know his whereabouts. So there, we'll accept even information that is not normally accepted as Edus. So there are extenuating circumstances, but under most circumstances, a woman does not testify in court. So with that in mind, where does that come from? Meaning, how do we know such a thing? So the Gemara's discussion over here today, very, very simple and basic discussion. How do I know that a woman does not testify? So the Torah, describing the judicial process in Parsha Shoftim, says that the two men are going to be standing. Who are these two men? The Edom Akas of Medaber. So the Gemara identifies, the Braisa identifies these men as being the Edom. Atomer be'edom I know lebebali dinim. How do I know? Maybe it's describing the litigants. Keshu amer shalahem ariv harei bali dinim amur. The Torah says that they are the ones who are quarreling, meaning not the ones just described, but rather the other two are the ones who are quarreling. The ones who are quarreling obviously are the litigants. So therefore, v'am dushnei anashim is referring to the edim. And how does the Torah describe them? The Torah doesn't describe them using the word edim. The Torah describes them using the word anashim. So that means they're men. Now, yes, it's true. Throughout the Torah, sometimes anashim could be just simply describing a population. And it could be referring to men and women. But over here, since the Torah could have written the word edim and instead chose to use the word anashim, so the Torah is telling us that these edim have to be men. Also, the Gemara points out that we have Gzeira Shava connecting this pasuk to another pasuk, which is clearly describing two men. So the Gzeira Shava tells us that the Shnei is referring to, and I'm sorry, and not just two men, but also witnesses as well. So the Gzeira Shava tells us that we're talking about Edom. So Mayim Meshach Lamar V'chitem Amidol Kasev Hashalayim Ariv Kulei Kura Bebali Dinam Mishtayei. So the Gemara says, look, why? Whenever you see a Braisa giving two arguments, obviously the first argument was not an absolute argument. It wasn't a rock solid argument. What was the problem with the first argument? So the Gemara goes on to explain. Because I might have thought that it had to have been just for that first pasuk. V'asher lehem lariv is actually qualifying the Shnei Anashim. Right? V'amdu Shnei Anashim. Right? V'asher lehem lariv is actually a description of those two men. So in other words, it's not talking about the witnesses, but rather it's talking about the litigants. Ne'emar kan shnei v'ne'emar lahalan shnei, ma lahalan be'edim, ma'af kan be'edim. So the Gzeira Shava sets forth now that the word shnei is a reference to edim. Okay, Tanya Idach. Gemara is going to quote a second Braisa. We're going to go through a number of Braisas this morning, all making the same point, just arriving there by different routes. Tanya Idach, the Gemara quotes another Braisa, Vamdu Shnei Ha'anashim. Be'edim Akasim Medaber. Again, same starting point. The Shnei Anashim being described in this pasuk is referring to the witnesses. Ato Omer Be'edim O'ayno Allah Be'abal Edinim Amar V'chit Shnayim Bayim Ledin, Shloshayim Bayim Ledin. Now, two people come to court, now three people come to court. Meaning that when we're talking about two, the number two was probably reflective of the fact that they are witnesses, not litigants. V'imav Sheikh Lama, the Gemara says, and I'm sorry, and let me just make this point a little bit better. And if we were talking about the litigants, Are the litigants capped at two? You can have more than two litigants. You can have a right, a class action suit. I mean, I know I'm speaking here in America, but in other words, you can certainly have on one side of litigation, you can have a group of people. It could be a partnership. And so if we're talking about litigants can be more than two. By virtue of the fact that the Torah says two, it's probably talking about the witnesses. Now, so the Gemara says, and the Brisa says, and we'll say parenthetically, if you don't like that, so then we have the Gzereshav. And the Gzereshav tells us that the Shnei over here is a reference to the Edim. And again, the Pasuk says, Anashim, that's the source that the Edim can only be men, not women. Mine Meshech Lamar, why did this Brisa give a second argument? What was wrong with the first argument? Look, the first argument was, why the number two? Meaning, if it's litigation, you can have three litigants, you can have four litigants. So the Gemara says that's not such a kasha, because when we're talking about litigation being two, there are two sides to litigation. Meaning we're talking about a monetary case, and in every monetary case, there may be multiple people involved, there may be four or five people involved, but in terms of the number of sides there are going to be to litigation, two. The Toveya, the Nidva. Tanya Yiduch, the Gemara quotes the third Brisa, Vam Dushnei Anashim Be'edim Akasa Medaber. Okay, so we're kind of used to this already by now. Third Brisa, same starting point. The Shnei Anashim stand up. That's a reference to the Edim. How do I know it's a reference to the Edim? Atomer beedim oyin ola babal edim, and maybe it's talking about the litigants. Amar v'chi anashim bayim ledin, anashim ein baos ledin. So, and the Gemara says, well, if it's talking about the litigants, well, men are going to go to litigation. Women don't go to litigation. Of course women go to litigation. Women are able to own things. Women have rights to ownership of money, and they could certainly be involved in litigation. Somebody wrongfully took money away from them, or they wrongfully took money away from somebody else. So for sure they can go to litigation. So if we're talking about the litigants, I don't understand how it can only apply to men, not to women. So the Imna Shech Lama, the Gemara says, and if that doesn't appeal to you, so now for a third round, the Gemara now, the Brisa brings us back to the idea that this could be a... it could also be a gzer shava, or it is a gzer shava on top of that. Mayin mafshech lamar. Now for the third round, we're going to ask the same question. Why does the Brisa bring us the gzer shava as a backup, as if something was wrong with the first argument? V'chitem isha lav orcha, lav orcha. If for a woman, even though she could go to court and she could go to litigation, it's just not proper for a woman to do so, mishum kol kvas bas melech panima, because a woman has more tznius and she's more protected, and a woman is home more often. So for her, it's inappropriate, therefore, to go to court and to stand in front of the judge, in front of the witnesses, and so therefore that the argument of, well, litigants, of course women are litigants because they can go to litigation. The counter argument to that is kol kvod bas melech panima. So therefore, nemar kan shnei v'nemar lahalan shnei ma lahalan be'edim av kan be'edim. So the Gemara says that's why the gzeirah shava is argument proof, because once you have a gzeirah shava, and a gzeirah shava, as long as it's mufna, not subject to any kind of pircha, you can't give any kind of counter argument when you're giving just an argument, which is what the Gemara did three times over. So obviously arguments are subject to you could poke at an argument. Okay, Tanur Rabbanan. With all that stated now, so three, really one source, but three different arguments provided in the three different brisas in terms of how we know that in terms of testimony, men testify and women do not testify. Tanur Rabbanan v'amdu shnei anashim mitzvah labal edin shiyamdu. So the pasuk says v'amdu shnei anashim, that they're going to stand. So that comes to teach us that it's the mitzvah for the baal din to stand when in court. Not only that, we said it three times over. Right. That's right. That's great. And then you hear much better when the Gemara keeps saying Ve'in Meshech Lomar, meaning as if the Gemara is saying it's not, you know, could be talking about the Edom, but also could not be talking about the Edom. All right, very good. So Ve'am Dushnei Anashim Mitzvah Labal Edim Shiamdu. So Amar of Yehuda Shemati Shim Ratzal Ahoshiv Eshneim Oshivim. So and Rav Yehuda says, I heard, I have a following tradition that if the if they want to sit, so by all means they can sit. But I'll tell you what you can't do. Ezu Aser, but what's going to be totally inappropriate? Shlo yechad amed ve'echad yoshev. Echad medaber kol tzarcha ve'echad amalo katzer dvarecha. What's going to happen, and it's totally inappropriate, is if you are showing clear favoritism to one litigant over the other litigant. So you point to one litigant, you say, hey, make yourself comfortable, sit down. You turn to the other litigant, you point to him, and says, don't you dare sit down. No, you stand. So now all of a sudden, now the discomfort in the courtroom. Meaning, because the one litigant's like, why is he shown the chair and made comfortable, and why am I made to stand? I don't understand. And so once you create any kind of partiality in the courtroom, so what you're doing now is you are perhaps showing a favoritism in the courtroom and you're not giving a balanced and fair trial. Similarly, says the Gemara, you can't say to somebody, oh, let me hear your side of the story. No, go on. Oh, give me some more details. And then to the other litigant, you say, okay, make this really short. 2 minutes. Now, you know what? 1 minute. Okay, can you sum it up in a sentence? And so, once again, you're now showing a partiality in the courtroom. And as a judge, you can't do that. You have to give fair representation to both sides of the case in order so that the trial would be as fair as possible. Tanur Rabban and the Gemara quotes a pasuk that also supports this idea. But tzedek tishpod amitecha. That when you are being a shofet, when you're judging, you should do so. But tzedek, you should be fair. Shelo ye'echad yoshev ve'echad ame. One person shouldn't sit, the other stand. Echad medabe kotzorcho ve'echad ame lo katzir dvarecha. One person, you ask him, please elaborate. And the other person says, okay, I've heard enough. Very good. So davar achir b'tzedek tishpod amitecha. Avidanes chavercha lekaf zechus. Also, while we're here, right, Mishnah Pirkei Avos, the Gemara here quotes it, the Braisa quotes it, right, when you see somebody, so what you should do is you should judge them favorably. My Rebbe in YU, he should have Refuah Shlema, so he always just said, you know, you have a mitzvah to judge favorably, you also have a mitzvah not to be stupid. So he says, you have to balance those two. So anyway, so Tani Rav Yosef, B'tzedek Tishpod Amitecha, Im She'etcha B'tor V'mitzvos, Hishtadel Adona Yafe. So then the Gemara says something which seems to go slightly against what we've been saying. And that is that if somebody is together with you in Torah Mitzvahs, so hishtadel adoni yafe. So give him a good trial. So the Gemara is going to explain that better in just a moment, because obviously that runs contrary to what we just said. Meaning we don't want to show any favoritism in the courtroom. And even if we have a propensity to show a certain individual some favoritism, for example, is a Talmid Chacham. So he comes in, and now the judges, who are obviously Talmid Chacham themselves, they could totally relate to him. And so at that point in time, what it sounds like Rav Yosef is saying is, yeah, show him a good case, show him a good trial. To which the Gemara is going to elaborate, because otherwise it's really hard to understand. So Ula Bere Rav Ila Havale Dina Kamid Rav Nachman. So Ula had a case in front of Rav Nachman, and Shalach Le Rav Yosef, Ula Chavareinu Amis Betor V'mitzvos. And so Rav Yosef sent a letter to Rav Nachman regarding Ula. You should know this Amora, Rav Ula, who's going to be sitting in front of you in case he's going to be he's going to have a case in front of you. So he's a Talmid Chacham. He knows Torah. He's familiar with Torah. He does mitzvos. Good. So Amar Lamai Shalachlei. So Rav Nachman's looking at this. Rav Nachman doesn't understand. Like, why am I getting this information? Not only do I not care, I shouldn't care. In other words, Lechanufilei. So in other words, then what are we talking about over here? Chanifa? He's just flattering him? Is that what he's trying to do? Chanifa is an Isser in the Torah. So Amar Lemishrei B'Tigre. So the Gemara says there are two things over here in which we should be showing some sort of preferential treatment when it comes to Talmid Chacham. In the case itself, we'll go back to what we said previously. Obviously, you should try to be as fair and balanced as possible. In other words, giving each side the fair amount of respect and time given in terms of presenting the case. So what are we talking about when we're saying that for a Talmid Chacham, you should judge him favorably? And what was the idea that Rav Yosef sent to Rav Nachman? Hey, this Ula is a Talmid Chacham. So the Gemara gives one of two suggestions. Number one, Hadar Amar Lemishra B'Tigre. So one possibility is Lemishra B'Tigre. Take a look at Rashi. What does Rashi say regarding that? So Rashi, Kedepricious in Badin Acher Lefanai Efsok Etzeh Tchila. So number one, put him to the front of the line, meaning that if you see a Talmid Chacham waiting in line, so you shouldn't let him wait. In other words, generally speaking, how does the court see cases? It's very simple. First come, first serve. In other words, basically take a ticket. So there's a counter in the front of the Beis Din, and then you know, number five, number six, next. So okay, hate to think of the Beis Din as the DMV, but okay. But in other words, but the first come, first serve. However, if somebody's a Talmid Chacham, so you should allow him to cut to the front of the line. Now, why should that be? So Gemara doesn't say, Rashi doesn't say, but you could suggest a couple things. Number one, as a Talmud Chacham, we have a mitzvah. We all have a mitzvah of kavod. We have to give him honor. So this could perhaps be a function of honoring him. Additional to that, in other words, for the Talmud Chacham, so his time is spent learning, and so therefore his time is, everyone's time is important, understood. But in other words, his time actually translates into learning, into Limud HaTorah, so that could be another reason why it is that he's sent to the front line. In any event, so that's one possibility in terms of what we're going to do regarding the Talmud Chacham. That's the preferential treatment of the Talmud Chacham. The Gemara gives another possibility. Inami, Lishuda Dayane. Shuda Dayane, what does that mean exactly? So Rashi and Tosfos classically debate that issue every time Shuda Dayane comes up. So Rashi and Tosfos have a debate regarding what that is. Here's no exception. Rashi over here on the top of the Amud Shuda Dayane. I'm reading the Rashi inside. Yesh din she'enu tala b'riyas lo b'riyas edem v'lo b'shvus ela b'masha leva dayanim no tala zakos l'chayev. So let's say there's a case where basically we don't have any testimony, we don't have any evidence. Basically, the judges right now have only their discretion in terms of determining what's going to be the outcome. Let's say, for example, Tuvia was awarded the land, and then comes into court two Tuvias. So now, it is totally within the purview of the discretion of the judges to basically make a decision. Or let's say you have two documents, both awarding a property to somebody, and it's dated the same day. And so now, which document was written first? So based on the information provided, we have literally no idea. And so now, once again, the court, the judges have their discretion to determine. I'm in a shuda dayane. Afkan kach shalach li im adin talib shuda dayane. Is there rather zechas or shechacham v'tzadiku? Shuda lashon hashlacha. Shuda means simply send it in this direction. So if you have a Talmud Chacham and now you have a case of Shuda Dayane, so now it's totally within the discretion of the court. Under those circumstances, the court now should favor the Talmud Chacham. That is Rashi's explanation of Shuda Dayane. So Shuda Dayane means basically no evidence, nothing clearly indicating one way or of another. Shuda Dayane now means basically it is within the discretion of the judges. Take a look at Tosfos over here.
Yeah. But in the application of this case, he's saying, just do it because he's a Talmud Chacham, right. not because this guy had a better relationship with that guy.
Right. And
that's
right.
The application.
Right. And that's going to go a little bit more in line with Tosfos, meaning see Tosfos over here. The perish Rabbeinu Tam de Mefar Shuda la Misha Yirtza Adayin Litein Yitein. So Tosfos over here, Tosfos doesn't say it as clearly as he says it elsewhere, but Tosfos over here says Shuda Dayane means that basically we have arrived at a stalemate, meaning not that it's totally within the discretion of the judges, but in other words, we do have evidence, but basically we've arrived at a stalemate. And now what the judges need to do is they need to intuit. They need to basically use whatever svara they have, intuition they have, in other words, in determining who should really be awarded. Meaning in Rashi's explanation, Shuda Dayane, it's totally just simply up to the discretion of the judges at this point in time, being that there's no evidence. According to Tosfos, and Tosfos over here doesn't say it as clearly as he says elsewhere, but according to Tosfos, no, this is much, much more based on an intuition. And, okay, in other words, in any event, so you are, under these circumstances, entitled to favor a Talmud Chacham and give him some sort of preferential treatment. Okay, Amar Ula. We are on the very top of Lamed Amud Beis. So far, what have we seen this morning on the Amud Aleph? The question of, the Mishnah we saw regarding Shuas HaDayanim, that it only applies to people who can testify. So the first rule of thumb, which is really literally the Mishnah's first rule of thumb, is that it applies to men, not to women. Men testify, women don't testify. And the Amud Aleph of today's daf recorded three different brises, three different arguments, and really one source in terms of how we know that men testify and women don't testify. On top of that, while we're here, we talked about the halachas of standing. In other words, it is a responsibility for a litigant to stand in court, although that was subject to a debate on the Amud Aleph. And then we talked about that there are rare occasions, exceptional cases, where a Talmud Chacham in court is going to get some sort of limited preferential treatment. With that stated, we now turn to the Amud Beis of today's daf. Amr Ula, machlokas bebalei dinim, ava be'edim divrei hakol be'amida. when it comes to a debate regarding whether you should stand or whether you shouldn't stand. Tanna Kamma says that the litigant should stand. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, they could sit if they like to. That's only as it relates to the litigants. Of Abbe Edom, when it comes to the actual witnesses themselves, according to everybody, so here we go back to the way we understood this pasuk in the beginning of the shir today. Amdu shnei anashim is a reference to the witnesses. So Amar Rav Huna machlokus b'shas maso matan. So the only debate over here is during deliberation of b'shas gemar din derek kol dayanim b'shiva ubalei dinim be'amida. But when it comes to the gemar din, so you have the judges sitting and you have the litigant standing. Dechsev vayeshem Moshe l'shpot es ha'am vayamod ha'am. So one source of this halacha that by the Gemar Din, judges are sitting and the litigants are standing is based on the pasuk in Parshas Yisro. Lishna achrina machlokus b'shas masomatan. The debate is only during deliberation. Ava b'shas Gemar Din, devar kol dayanim b'shiva v'alei dinim b'amida. So far this lishna achrina sounds almost identical to what we said previously. Here comes the difference. Daha edim ki Gemar Din dame uksei behu v'amdu shnei anashim. Here in this lishna achrina, it's a different argument that's given in terms of why it is that the litigant should be standing at the end. Because we know that the witnesses need to be standing when they're offering the testimony. Witnesses offering testimony is like Gemar Din. Why is that like Gemar Din? Because vis-a-vis the witnesses, as far as the witnesses are concerned, that's it. Meaning this is the testimony they're providing, that they're not giving any of, this is their legal contribution to the case. So in other words, for them, this is it. This is the end of the road. So once you get to the end of the road vis-a-vis the litigation, regarding the litigants, meaning the Gemar Din, so they should be standing as well. Gemar tells the following story. Devasar de Rav Huna havalei dina kami de Rav Nachman. The wife of Rav Huna had a case in front of Rav Nachman. Now, despite the fact that we said in the Amud Aleph of today, that kol kvoda baz melech panima, and maybe can make an argument that a woman shouldn't go to court, but remember, that's a value. In other words, that certainly has a certain value to it, but of course, make her, then women can go to court. Also, Rashi points out over here, Devasar de Rav Huna, mishameis Rav Huna. That could be motivating Rashi. Meaning, why isn't Rav Huna going and litigating on her behalf? So Rashi gives a simple solution to that problem, and that Rav Huna is no longer with us. So in other words, she's a widow. So that could be what's motivating Rashi, but in any event. So Devasar de Rav Huna havalei dina kamei de Rav Nachman. So the litigation in front of Rav Nachman, and Amar Eichen Avid. And now Rav Nachman was in a little bit of a bind. Because, look, I really should be standing for her. She's the wife of a Talmud Chacham. I need to give her kavod. So, and that means I really should stand for her. But if she comes in, I stand for her. And the other litigant sees that I stood for the other litigant, for her, so obviously that's going to create a lack of balance in the courtroom. And you can't do that like we learned the Yamad Alf of today. So, And what am I therefore supposed to do? Not stand for her? She's the Yeshus Chavra. I should be standing for her. So, So he has a really creative solution. And the creative solution is that he turns to the bailiff and he says to the bailiff, hey, do me a favor. Have a bird fly through my courtroom, which in of itself is strange, but I guess back then they had birds in the courtroom. So have a bird fly over me, and you know, and I'm going to have to stand like as if I'm looking like to avoid the bird. And meanwhile, my real intent in standing is to stand for the wife of Rav Huna, the Eishes Chaver. So, in general, you should know that when the Gemara in Kedushin talks about standing, the Gemara says a number of different ways, but the basic idea of the Gemara over there is that you have to, when you stand, you have to clearly demonstrate that you're showing cover for the person. In other words, the act of standing has to be a clear demonstration that I am honoring that individual. So over here, right, Tosos makes this point. This is not me. So over here, so it's a little bit strange because it is a creative way to stand for the wife of the widow of Rav Huna, and not to offend the other person or not to create imbalance in the courtroom, but the truth of the matter is that this standing is not a clear demonstration that he's showing kavod. Okay, so, but in other words, but what he's trying to do, obviously, is he himself is trying to balance, meaning balance the requirement of standing for a nation's chaver at the same time, not creating an imbalance in the courtroom. So the Gemara says now, they say to Rav Huna, but wait one second. So I'm sorry, not Rav Huna, sorry. They say to Rav Nachman, but wait one second. So you're going to be standing right now in the courtroom, and you're going to continue standing. Look, we all are in agreement that when it comes to the Gemar Din, you need to be sitting for the Gemar Din. Now, it's interesting because, unbeknownst to me, what's happening now in the courtroom is that Rav Nachman not only stood for her, but remained standing for her, and the Gemara is assuming that he remained standing for the duration of the case, including the Gemara Din as well. And that's why the Gemara is bothered by the fact that at the point of Gemara Din, aren't we all in agreement that that the judge has to sit? And over here now Rav Nachman's going to stand? So the Gemara says, Diyasav Kamand Shadi Misane. So the Gemara says, you know what he's doing? He's going to basically bend over in order to tie his shoelaces. So, and so, right, it's covert standing, covert sitting, every position over here undercover. But but anyway, so he'll now bend over to tie his shoelaces, and so that will be tantamount to sitting. And now, while in this very awkward position, but now at least he has the halachic benefit of sitting. And you know, obviously, the Gemara seems to represent a chiddush over here, in that even though he's not physically sitting, but simply being in a hunched position is, you know, tantamount to sitting. And then he can issue the verdict, and that would be fine.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Favoritism.
So, in which case, meaning
you're standing up for a Talmud Chacham.
Right.
So of course I'm going to judge him better than the other.
Agreed. In other words, so he was trying to balance it. So he came up with this creative solution of standing while not looking like he's standing for her. Okay, agreed. It's right.
Regular.
I mean, I mean.
It's interesting. The concern is not that you're showing him cover, but the concern is that you're going to be masking the other.
Right. So it's correct. Correct. That's what he's trying to accomplish. So if you have a Talmud Chacham and a Nama Aretz who have a litigation one against the other, so as far as the Talmud Chacham is concerned, so you sit him down. As far as the Nama Aretz is concerned, you invite him to sit down. Now, if he decides to stand out of respect for the Talmud Chacham, so that's fine. Meaning that would be okay, because once you give him the invitation to sit, you at least give him that sense of, look, he has the right to, he's going to sit, and you have the right to sit. And if it's your option to stand, that's your prerogative. But at least you gave him the sense that you have you're on equal footing with the other litigant. Rav Barshaya Havale Dina Kami de Rav Papa. Rav had litigation together with Rav Papa, and Ezev Osev Naim Labal Dine. So he sat him down, and he also sat down the other litigant. Also, Shlicha de Beidina Batashleg, V'ukme La Amaritz, V'lo Amale Rav Papa Tiv. And so what happened is along comes the bailiff, and the bailiff takes the other litigant and kicks him. And he kicks him so that he stands, meaning, you know, your other litigant is a Talmud Chacham, you should stand. So the Gemara says, Now, under what grounds did he do such a thing? V'hamistatim Tanaise. So the Gemara says, but there's stimas taina, meaning now you're basically giving the sense of, hey, he's a Talmud Chacham, he's better, he's preferential, and you're going to stand for him. And now, imagine how he feels, and imagine now how he has lost a little bit of confidence and now making his arguments, and that's not the kind of courtroom that we want to set up. So Amar Papa, Meima Amar, Ihu Usvan, Shlichu Dula Mifais Mine. So the Gemara says, well, maybe over here would be okay, because the assumption is, it's a curious assumption, but the assumption is that when the bailiff is doing so, the bailiff is doing so on his own accord, and he's not doing so under the instruction of the judge. And so therefore, as far as the judge is concerned, the judge can still be viewed as an impartial source, and the courtroom is still going to be balanced. That's the Gemara's argument of why the bailiff's kicking is not necessarily creating an imbalance in the courtroom. Once again, a scenario in which you have a Talmud Chacham and Amaretz having litigation one against the other. You can't have the Talmud Chacham come in first and sit down first. And now what's going to happen is that the Amaretz is going to come into the courtroom, sees the Talmud Chacham already sitting in the courtroom, and once again, he's going to have that feeling, have that sense of, hey, this is an unfair trial. And again, you're going to be so same as Tainus. You're going to close off his arguments. Now the Gemara says that's only if there isn't a regular shear on that time. Meaning, let's say, for example, there was a kvias to learn, and it happens to be that the dayan and the litigant had a regular shear at that point in time. So under those circumstances, it would be okay. Meaning, I could still, when all said and done, like in other words, the other litigants coming into the courtroom, I could still imagine that, oh, it's okay, it's, you know, it's a daf yomi, you know, they regularly learn together. But okay. All right. Meima amar bi'inei tarid. So they will say to himself simply that bi'inei tarid, meaning it's their time to normally learn, and therefore it's normal. So, if you have a Talmud Chacham who knows testimony, however, zile be milsa, it's just simply, it's beneath him, to go to a court where the people there in the court are beneath him, so he shouldn't go. So, Ama Rav Shisha Bereda Rav Ida Afanami Tanina. In fact, the Gemara Bava Metzia we're all familiar with is that if you find a sack or some sort of bag and it is not it's not within your kavod to bend down and pick it up, but the Gemara points out this is only as it relates to monetary law. But when it comes to Yisurim, so there are circumstances in which Kavod HaRav is going to override, but that's only when it comes to monetary cases. When it comes to Issur V'Heter, so then there's no such concept of Kavod HaRav. The Gemara in Brachos and Daf Yotes, it discusses this extensively. This idea of when it comes to Yisurim, there's no concept of Kavod HaBrios. But when it comes to monetary law, so then Kavod HaBrios, Kavod HaRav is going to override and it's going to supersede monetary laws. We see that in terms of Hashavas Aveda, and we see that in terms of testifying on behalf of somebody else. Okay, we'll stop over here. Okay, our daf today started off the fourth parak of Shavuos. We talked out the idea that the only one eligible for the Karban Olah V'Yarid is somebody who can testify. Three different arguments the Gemara gives in terms of how we know that a man can testify, not a woman can testify. Various proceedings in the courtroom, preferential treatment to a Talmid Chacham under limited circumstances. And we spoke about the practices of standing and sitting. Judges at the verdict should be sitting. The litigant should be standing. Debatable whether during Masa Matan the litigant should be standing as well. And then a discussion of various practices that were done regarding a Talmid Chacham in the courtroom.